Hello, everyone, and welcome to Cinema Joes, the podcast where three average Joes discuss the significant topics in movie culture. My name is Justin Mancini. I am one of your co-hosts here today. And I am here with another co-host. He is the podcast editor for thepopbreak.com, Alex Marcus. How you doing?
Good. Happy anniversary, Justin.
Yeah.
We've been recording since March of 2017. Can you believe it?
Happy birthday from all of us to you. We wish it was our birthday so we could party too.
And betraying his presence before I've had the time to properly introduce him is, of course, my co-host, Noah France, one of my co-hosts actually on another podcast that we've done, Pod on the Rooftops, a Genesis podcast. Please welcome Noah France.
Oh, it's your birthday. All right. That's my last Emperor's New Groove reference for the night.
Those were Emperor's New Groove references?
You don't remember the birthday party scene? The birthday song
I
scene?
I never watched that movie. Not even what in my year fuck, of quarantine Alex. Did I watch that movie.
What the hell? Well, welcome, guys, to the last episode of Cinema Joes, because we're breaking up after this.
You've heard about the live-action remake they're doing of that, right, Noah?
I will kill it with my bare hands.
I kid. I just wobbled it into existence. So
John Goodman is spinning in his grave. Back.
He is still alive. Anyway, why are we here today? We are here, usually on this podcast, we discuss recent movie releases, as well as a broader topic in film culture related to movie releases. And this is a time, I think, where 2020, just being the year that it was a little bit difficult to do that. We did do a few, but we did kind of go away from that structure for a little while to talk about some favorite movies with some guests. But, you know, with the movie theaters being closed, we thought it would be a good idea to talk about other movies we've been watching that we've maybe had the chance to catch up with in our quarantine. There will be an episode about 2020 movies, which should be going up. And we thought this would be a good opportunity to talk about some other movies that we caught up with. And we're going to be running through a couple of different categories. It's a little bit different from our year-end reviews. This is the way we're going to be doing it on today's show. First, we'll be talking about a favorite classic film that we saw for the first time in 2020. This could be anything from, typically should be a little bit older, but really could be anything, because our second category is going to be our favorite recent film that we believe should be a classic or has the potential to be within the last 10 years that we saw in 2020. And then we're going to be talking about an actor or a director we fell in love with, someone whose work we discovered for the first time, maybe saw multiple of their movies, and perhaps want to see more. So that kind of gives us a broad range to work with. And lastly, we'll be talking about our best rewatch, a movie that we rewatched in 2020 that was either maybe an even more positive experience than the first time, or maybe we didn't like the first time that we loved this time. I'm really curious to hear what you guys have picked for all these categories. I don't honestly, unlike our 2020 show, I feel like I don't have as good an idea of what you guys chose for this, just because it could be so broad. Let's start with talking about
to pick from Justin.
Yes, assuming we made the time to see it, then yes, absolutely.
I did not.
Let's start by talking about our favorite classic film. I thought we should start with you, Alex, on this particular category. So what new film classic did you discover in 2020?
Okay, so I, like many people in the world, spent a great deal of time watching films from the past this year because there wasn't a lot else to do out there, right? Work was weird, you couldn't socialize outside of your home, so why not finally sit down and watch the things that I always wanted to watch? In fact, part of me felt like this was a weird sort of like monkey's paw situation, because I have long said, and probably on this podcast as well, I just wish I could just take like a year off from life and just catch up on all the things I always wanted to watch. And God help me, I had the chance to do that.
The universe turned to God and said, hold my beer.
Yeah, basically. Spoiler alert for God is that at a certain point I started playing The Sims and stopped watching as many movies. But for a while, I got to really catch up on a lot of the classics. And two of the best films that I saw all year last year are two films that are just excellent. And I'm going to say two because you know I hate to say one. And also because a lot has been said about both, so I don't need to talk about either in too much depth. But I finally watched Citizen Kane, you guys. And I did it way before Mank came out, for the record. It's great. It's Orson Welles' classic film. Is it the best film that ever existed? I don't know. Probably not. But it's so much better than I expected. I expected it to be a movie that I, like, respected but didn't particularly like, because it's, like, you know, it has so many technical achievements and that's what its reputation is. But it's also just incredibly fun and dynamic and well-paced and, like, a murder mystery of a kind. It's so fun. It's such like an interesting conceit for people who haven't watched it and also didn't watch Mank earlier this year, which is of course about the making of, or at least the writing of, Citizen Kane. This movie is basically just like about like a titan of industry who kind of and who is so many different things to different people, and the film is kind of using this interesting flashback structure to try to decipher who this man truly was. And I think ultimately it decides that like you can never really know who a person is. And I think that that's super interesting. And there's been a lot of films that I have loved in the past that are clearly influenced by those themes in retrospect. Did not realize that. And yeah, it's a great film. It's really, really fun. People should stop talking about how boring it is because they're insane. It's like an actual fun movie. There's like a lot of like Orson Welles as Kane is great. And he's surrounded by really strong theater actors who do a great job in like all of these various supporting roles. And yeah, it's a really fun time, you guys. Why do people talk about this movie like it's boring?
Orson Welles' performance deserves to be on any top 10 list of the most pure charismatic performances in cinematic history. It is amazing just how, like, it doesn't even matter what's happening in the specific scene, and even what age he is, because we see him as an older man as well. He just draws your eyes to him every time he's on the camera.
Yeah, it's crazy to think that he was like 25 or whatever when he did. It's just like
have to say, something that holds up very well in the movie is the age makeup. Like it doesn't look bad when you see older Kane or when the other characters age as well. Like it obviously has nothing on like modern digital effects to like age people.
But, I don't know. I think it's a lot better than a lot of the modern digital effects that are used to age people in certain movies that I won't name.
Like, I would not have, when I first saw it, I was like, it looks good. The age makeup looks really good. It looks fine. Yeah. It doesn't look like someone put a clump of Play-Doh on their face or something like that, you know? Like, it's really good.
Yeah. The black and white helps, certainly, but yeah, I agree.
Well, yeah, I think that, yeah, that is a part of it, but...
Justin, yeah. Do you know why people think this movie is boring?
I have a theory. I think it's become so associated with being this pioneer in the movie, not just industry, but world, that I think people start to see it more for its technological innovations than for the story, which when I saw it for the first time, I was like, that was what I was interested in. And a lot of those, I don't think people are wrong to point out those innovations. Those innovations are always in service to the story. It's not just there for the sake of pioneering the industry. And I think it's the kind of thing I would want to, for people who are discovering it for the first time or who are interested in watching it but know its reputation, to say, just if you can remove as much of that, like this you know, the vaulted position of which it's held, like the greatest movie of all time, that certainly doesn't help. That definitely sets it up, I think, in a way for disappointment. But I think regardless, it's one of those things, like there are great movies that some people consider the greatest of all time. And I'm just like, you know what? I don't need it to be the greatest of all time. I don't even know what my favorite, like what I consider the greatest movie of all time. They're just great. They're just, you know, like, let's just, can't we leave it at that? Can't we have a myriad of great movies, and does one necessarily have to win out over the others? No. I mean, I don't know. That's
just,
I like, that's everyone, my guess. My
everyone
guess
knows
is,
it's Highlander rules. Like, there can only be one great film.
I think my guess is the people who walk away saying it's boring are the people who were told for years, greatest film of all time, greatest film of all time, masterpiece, masterpiece. And of course, every person has their own subjective idea of what, in air quotes, the greatest movie of all time should look or feel like. And I think most people do not think a black and white character drama told from various perspectives is, you know, what I think for most people, that's not what falls under, in air quotes, the greatest films of all time. So I think those are the people who walk away saying it's boring. They've been told for years it's the greatest film of all time. They couple that with a very specific expectation in their head of what makes something the greatest. And then they watch it and you're like, oh, well, that's not what I was expecting at all. Nah, not that great.
I guess you're probably right, but like there's literally attraction. Like, there's literally a scene in this movie where, like, Orson Welles brings in a bunch of showgirls and they do, like, a conga line. Like, this is not a boring movie.
I mean, there are lots – we know there are lots of people who are like, oh, black and white, garbage. Throw it in the trash. Don't bother. Yeah. So that's – yeah. Or there was something – there was some Twitter thread that people were dumping on a short while ago on, see, this is why I have a rule. I never watch anything from before 1970. You know, like
– oh, well –
The less we get into that ridiculous conversation, the better. The other movie that I wanted to talk about briefly is Pather Panchali, directed by Satyajit Ray. This is the first film of the Apu trilogy, which is a kind of Criterion classic. I've not caught up with the other two yet, but I loved this film so much. It was just so beautiful and lyrical and just life-affirming and just, like, it had such a scope, and while also being very specifically about one family just, like, trying to exist in the world and all of the sort of beautiful and harrowing and complicated mess of life within that context. It's such a fantastic film. The making of this film that I learned afterwards is just wild. Like, this, like, Ray was a guy who was who taught himself how to be a filmmaker, and he shot this movie like on the weekends while he was off from his day job, and it took him forever to make it, and it looks just amazing and beautiful, and it's just such a revolutionary film. And like, you don't have a Terrence Malick without Ray first, you know. It's just this film is just incredible, and I'm really excited to finally having the time to catch up with the other two films in the trilogy later on. Abu, by the way, is the young boy of the family. So we follow his journey through life in this trilogy, and this is about his young childhood. And it's just incredible. There's moments in it that I'll remember forever, and like some of those moments are just like the wind like rustling through a patch of grass. Like, it's just remarkable. Yeah. Like how powerful cinematic it is. It's in a lot of ways very much like the opposite of what Citizen Kane is doing, in that it's so much like about like Citizen Kane is all like
what?
Plot
no
and character and structure, and you know, and Pather Panchali is so much about just like sitting in the quietness of what it's like to live a life, and in a way they're both trying to kind of answer similar questions, and I just love the broad flexibility that film allows, that you can come at it in two such fundamentally opposed ways and still find some interesting truth at the end of the day.
Yeah, that whole trilogy was in the first set of 100 great movies that Roger Ebert wrote special tributes to and published. So I've not seen it yet, but it's on the list of classic films that I've at some point. I got
Justin, have you ever watched it?
I have not. This is a big blind spot for me. It's someone I've been aware of for so long. Yeah, I've heard him talked about just with nothing but praise from both filmmakers and critics. I know if I'm remembering correctly, I may be paraphrasing. I don't remember the exact quote, but I remember like Pauline Kael talking about his films and saying it's like discovering like all these discovering like potential and possibilities of the cinematic form that you would not have been able to otherwise. And I'm just like, wow, I feel like I've seen a lot of movies, but like if I haven't seen this, maybe I'm like, I feel like I'm missing out on something like really fundamental about the movies.
There's so many movies that you love.
Of those things that I love to see.
There's so many movies that you love that can draw inspiration from this film, either directly or indirectly. Yeah. So I definitely think you would like it a lot.
Oh, I'm sure. Mm. Yeah. I'll just add that to my list of 1 million other titles.
It is currently streaming on the Criterion Channel, if anyone's interested in watching.
Not available here.
And Citizen Kane is on HBO Max in the States, so you can check it out there.
Great. So I'm gonna go next. I'll go something a little bit different. And actually, I'm gonna go with a concert film, which I don't know if we usually get to discuss that on this on this podcast. But I'm going to. It is not. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily call it a concert film. I mean, it has concert footage in it, kind of. It's more of like a mockumentary, I guess. I'm gonna go Stop Making Sense from 1984. The Jonathan Demme directed film of the Talking Heads, their concert at the Pantages Theater in Hollywood in 1983. It's largely considered the greatest concert film ever made by critics. Having seen it, I can't say I've seen a ton of concert films in my time. I've seen a few. I mean, I think The Last Waltz about the band is very good. The Martin Scorsese directed film. But this, having seen this, it's kind of hard to disagree with the consensus. For those who don't know, this is about this is a concert from the Talking Heads, rock band from the late 70s and into the 80s. They kind of broke up in the early 90s or so. One of the things about the Talking Heads, they were led by David Byrne, who was the singer. He was also the primary songwriter, although I would say the other band members were just as essential to that band. One of the things about the Talking Heads that I kind of discovered their music in 2020. I knew some of their stuff, but I didn't really have like a full picture of their oeuvre. And I'm really glad I checked them out, because I realized like they have all this great stuff beyond just what you would hear on the radio. You know, your Once in a Lifetimes, your Life During Wartime, all those hits, which are still very good. One of the things about the Talking Heads that I think is very unique in music is they're esoteric without being inaccessible. The subject matter is usually maybe harder to put your finger on, but the way in which it's delivered with this very sort of catchy sort of synth pop is like a nice counterbalance. Like it never feels like something that anyone couldn't just pick up and dance to. And the way that Demme does this film, you know, I think there's been some talk. I know Josh Larson from the Film Sliding podcast has talked about how he admired Demme for just like getting out of Byrne's way and just like letting his vision come through. I don't really agree with that, at least not 100%. I think what Demme was good at as a director was facilitating that vision. Mm-hmm. I think without him, without having that cinematic know-how of how to achieve it, I'm not sure David Byrne could have made this film on his own. So I want to give a lot of credit to Demme and his role in bringing this vision to life. And the way it functions is I would almost describe it in some ways, it's less a concert film than it almost feels like a musical. Albeit without a plot, without a real story, but definitely there's an arc. There's an emotional through line to this movie, and it's just in the way that it's structured, with the way that it begins. The first song is just David Byrne singing. The second song, they bring out the bassist, Tina Weymouth, and then the third song, they bring out the drummer, and they keep adding members of the band when they actually start adding other like session musicians, which just gives them like a lot more range with the percussion, for example, or provides other instruments. They get to, you know, they get like background singers, which they keep adding on layers of sound. And as it goes along, you can see like Byrne becoming more comfortable. You can see the interactions between between the performers, which is something you really can't get just listening to the music. That's one of the things I love about concerts, is watching those musicians interact and connect with one another and with the audience. That's one of the things I miss about concerts. And that's just all on display here. This film is just pure joy from beginning to end. There's not a bad song that's performed. I would even defend the Tom Tom Club song, which is not a Talking Heads song, but is a song from Tina Weymouth and the drummer Chris France, and their musical project. I would even defend that. I love that. But like I said, it's something that feels like it was so deliberately made and fussed over in such a loving way. And it makes you realize just so many concert films are just content to be that. I mean, I've seen concert films from some of my favorite artists that don't have this kind of deliberate structure to them. And yet in a way that's still like equally as fun. That's something you don't really see very often. And yeah, I don't know. This is definitely, this was definitely a highlight for me. I believe I watched this, believe it or not, I think I watched this on Tubi, which actually has ads. Like you can watch things free with ads. And somehow, I don't know, maybe this was just, you know, some sort of supernatural benevolent force or something, but none of the commercial breaks interrupted any of the songs. And so thank you, Tubi, at least for that. this is a really wonderful movie. I definitely need to see more Jonathan Demme films. I haven't seen a ton, but it was just interesting for me to see this one in particular. It's different from Silence of the Lambs, to be sure, or from Philadelphia, but it feels like the work of a very compassionate director. And, that's something I think we all really need right now.
Yeah, I over the course of like late 2019 and early 2020, I caught up with all of Jonathan Demme's films except basically for this one and Swimming to Cambodia, the other one that he did. That was more of like a documentary style. And that's honestly just because, it was a lot of movies to watch. But I just don't really care about the Talking Heads or music as much as you guys do. But I'm really glad that you watched this. I love the Jonathan Demme movies that I've seen, especially Rachel Getting Married is my like one of my all-time favorite films and a classic. And I'm really curious, Justin, did you see the most recent David Burns concert film, American Utopia, which was directed by Spike Lee and also came out this year?
I did. I was definitely a big fan of that one. Not as big a fan as this one. Part of that might be the music, but also I just think this one holds together in a way that maybe American Utopia is a little more because of its ambitions, I think is maybe gets a little bit lost in like some of the messaging. And I think here it's just like all this kind of streamlined concert. So I was a fan of that one, but not as much as Stop Making Sense.
And I will say, if you guys don't want to sit through the ads of Tubi, Stop Making Sense is currently streaming on Amazon Prime Video as well.
Nice. All right. Well, let's go to you, Noah, for your classic film that you discovered in 2020.
All right. Well, I went into the year planning to revisit David Fincher's The Social Network for my film Films for the Trump Year series on my blog. Then it just so happened that this year was the 25th anniversary of Seven. I had seen neither Seven nor Zodiac, both of which are considered classic David Fincher movies. And I took the time to see both of those over the summer so that I could enjoy all of the nice content that The Ringer was putting out in honor of David Fincher. And they are, like, they're both movies where you watch them, you can tell that they're very much from the same mind, even though I would say Zodiac is certainly more procedural than Seven. Seven is certainly a much darker and grittier film in terms of its visuals and its not so much its themes, but it's also very much it's definitely also a more graphic film. But I took the time to see both of those films and finally see some of the classic David Fincher films. I still haven't seen all of his works, but they were both really, really great films. And I'm so glad that I've finally been able to see them now. And especially in regards to Seven, a whole new world of box related memes has now opened up to me, and I'm very grateful for that.
Seven I haven't seen in a while, and Zodiac is still unseen by me. Another blind spot for me is a decent amount of Fincher stuff. Yep.
Have you not seen Zodiac?
I hadn't seen it until this past summer, so.
It's one of those things. Well, it's because I want to do it. At some point, I'm going to do a Fincher marathon, and I just that keeps getting pushed back because of other things.
Mm-hmm.
And this came out in the exact period right before I started watching everything from a given year. And
sure.
Also, this was at a time where I honestly didn't watch even the ones that were getting a lot of attention. I was just not following the sort of critical consensus for a given year. So. It took me a while to, kind of be oh, this is considered a classic. I remember it being out in the theater and maybe watching snatches of it on my breaks when I was working at the movie theater. But apart from that, I'm oh, it's apparently considered a classic.
Mm.
Yeah. Very, very interesting experience I've had with this movie.
Yeah. No, one of the articles that The Ringer did that I especially liked was on how on the importance of basement scenes in David Fincher movies. Specifically highlighting the basement scene in Zodiac and how he always finds ways to use basements as not even necessarily explicitly in a horror setting, but just as dark places where horrible secrets go to be uncovered at the worst possible moment and in the worst possible way. And that is, having finally seen Zodiac, I completely get why they decided to devote the article to that scene. It is I would say it is the most, even in spite of everything else that happens in the movie, that is definitely the most unsettling part of that movie. But just because of how it's set up and not because of anything that actually happens on screen. Whereas Seven is an intense and at times incredibly horrifying movie, mostly, though not entirely, mostly because of what you actually do see in front of you on screen regarding the crimes and the murders that Brad Pitt and Morgan Freeman's detectives are trying to find the solution to.
Yeah, I mean, we could have a much longer discussion about these two films together because they really work interestingly as complements of each other. But my opinion is that Zodiac is the much better film. It's it is also the much more mature film, in my opinion. It's Seven, as you said, is the movie where it's what if we show you all the crazy stuff? And Zodiac is oh, no, actually, it's more effective if we don't know. That's the not knowing is way more horrific than seeing the horrific thing. And I think that's a sign of Fincher's maturation as a filmmaker during Seven, I think is his best period.
Seven shows that Seven has moments where you're okay, he clearly gets this. There are certain lines that he deliberately does not cross in Seven in a couple of key moments.
Yeah. And Zodiac just getting into our, just squeaking past our criteria for what would be considered a classic, right? We said it had to be at least it had to be past 10 years old for it to be in this segment. So,
I mean, Social Network is the cutoff. That was 2010.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think Social Network is already considered a modern classic by most people. So I'm not that movie does not need me to toot its horn.
Yeah, sadly, is something that does not seem like it's going to be considered a modern classic from David Fincher anytime soon is Mank.
bringing it all around.
Well, definitely the theme of this episode so far seems to be shaming me for the movies that I haven't seen yet.
Alex, get your cowbell. Shame.
So let's continue that by seeing what recent films within the past 10 years that should be classics I also haven't seen. Maybe I'll go back to you, Noah, for this first category.
So a recent movie that should be or should become a classic. Like I said, not Social Network. Already considered a modern masterpiece by most viewers and critics. But one movie, and I went back through my favorites of the decades list. I think for the most part, the movies that I picked for my top 10 for that list are already or will eventually be established as some of the best movies of all time. However, one of my personal favorites from the past decade that I still think is underrated, even though it does have its following, is Cloud Atlas. I will continue to go to bat for this movie because I still don't think that it quite gets its due. There are certain critiques of the film, of some of its creative choices in terms of the production, in terms of some of its storytelling. There are certain critiques that I can get as to why someone would not consider it to be like a perfect film, or why it was someone would say that they personally don't like it. But it's just, it's one of those movies where every time I go back to it, there's more stuff in the story, in the writing, in the production that catches my eye, or that I'd never noticed before, or some new aspect of the performances that I learned to appreciate even more than I did. It's just, it's one of those movies that just has pretty much everything that I could want in a movie, and it has still not been seen and appreciated by nearly enough people.
What was it like watching it in 2020?
Still great.
I just, like, did anything jump out at you on this most recent rewatch?
I mean, specifically related to 2020, no. I think the thing that I most recently became appreciative of is how there's a motif. It's a very specific recurring motif of one of Tom Hanks's characters. Because for anyone who's not seen the movie, like the basic conceit of the film was that it's kind of like six short stories, or almost like six short films. That are interspersed, and you cut between different timeline, different times and eons and places and characters, but there's a heavy theme of reincarnation. So you have the same cast of actors who are clearly reincarnating across, like literally across genders and races or ethnicities through eons of time. And Tom Hanks is one of the lead characters, and he's in all six of the stories. He's in all six of them. And one recurring motif that I hadn't noticed until this latest rewatch was one of him digging in the ground and finding a button, or at least something that looks like a button. In some of the later stories, it is clearly shown to be a button that an earlier character of his wore, and that a later character is like finding just in the ground of a forest in like this post-apocalyptic future. But it also opens with the Tom Hanks character in the earliest story, as far as the timeline is concerned, digging for teeth in a beach that used to be used by a race of cannibals. And is picking up stuff and examining stuff from the soil in the same way that the Tom Hanks character in the last timeline story finds this that a previous incarnation of the film had actually worn. And it's a tiny, tiny detail. And it's just a couple of moments, and it's literally blink and you miss them. But it astounds me that they went to that level of detail to reinforce the themes of the very cyclical themes of the movie in terms of evolution and deprivation and people rising and people falling and still coming back to the same themes. Yeah. So nothing 2020 specific, like nothing about 2020, like, oh, clearly this film, like nothing about the nothing pandemic related, like made me see the film in a new light. It was just another detail in the movie that I hadn't caught before, but I caught it this time and I was like, wow. That's amazing. Like, how do you think of that?
So sometimes those details are like, that's why we go back and watch movies again, you know?
Yep.
I'm a big fan of that film. I think like it's certainly like makes a lot of bold choices that I don't know if you would make today. But it has its heart is in the right place. And the editing of that film, where all of these different storylines crossing time and space crescendo at the same points is just pretty astounding, and nothing really parallels to it. One thing that I have not rewatched it recently, but I have been thinking about it because in the film and in the book that it is based, in the far future timeline, all movies are known as Disney's, and that certainly feels like a trajectory that we're headed towards.
Oh boy. Oh, I forgot about that.
Yeah, now that you mention it.
I haven't seen it since we actually talked about it on an earlier incarnation of this podcast.
Yeah, no, it has been a while. Since we did that, and I have to say, like, Nick, this year is going to be the 10th year that I will do a top 10 list for my film blog, and so next year I want to rank myself and go back and revisit all of my number one picks for the past 10 years. And I know that I'm going to be writing a lot about it. I ultimately picked Lincoln for that year, and I put Cloud Atlas at number 2 on my list, purely because I was thinking, well, Lincoln is the more conventional mainstream movie, so I kind of have to pick that one. I should have been brave. I should have just said, nope, Cloud Atlas is the best movie that came out that year, because it was. I
famously don't like Lincoln, so I would agree with you that Cloud Atlas is better than that, but it's a conversation for another time, unless it's Justin's modern classic that he wants to bring up right now.
Yeah, so when I was looking back on the films from the last 10 years that I watched in 2020, there wasn't a whole lot. And I think that's because I tended to watch either movies from that year or from the previous year or from like before, like well before, like the, you know, like 90s and or older. So I didn't have a ton to choose from for this. And actually, I guess I'm going to kind of like Noah did. This is actually one that was a rewatch for me. I will have a different rewatch movie later. And it's a film we've talked about and maybe have even talked, hopefully we haven't talked it to death at this point, but it is one that I truly believe should be a classic. And it's Xavier Dolan's Mommy from 2014.
Yay.
I rewatched this as part of my, I actually did a Xavier Dolan marathon, which Alex himself did much earlier than I did way back when. That was part of the reason why I wanted to do it, was because I remember Alex asking me and saying like, hey, do you want to do a Dolan marathon? And I was like, yeah, not thinking like, oh, but I'm going to watch this and this and this. And then eventually Alex was like, I'm just going to watch it. And
I think that was about 2 years ago, but that's okay.
If there's any theme in my life, especially when it comes to movie watching or movie reviewing, it's better late than never. So this film, we have, like I said, we have mentioned before, so I won't go into too much depth, but it's about a single mother trying to raise her adolescent son who appears to have ADHD, also with violent tendencies, and gets some help from a neighbor who is a teacher who's been taking a break. And I just think what's so... part of the reason why I loved it, especially this time, I'd seen it one other time before, way back when, and I remember loving it then, but something about seeing it this time just made me think, oh, no, like, this is a masterpiece. Like, you know, I might have liked it, but, like, this was like watching it anew in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. I have kind of, in some ways, like, I would say mostly positive, but maybe a little more mixed opinions on Dolan's sort of, like, output in general. I don't think that's necessarily a different thing from other directors that I've watched, but I would say, I don't know, unlike maybe someone like, you know, I've mentioned before, like Kelly Reichardt or Rian Johnson, or like directors who I didn't know a lot about them and then watched their films and kind of became fans. I don't know if Dolan is in that company for me, but this film definitely is. And he's so good here at modulating tone. One of the things that we get in this movie are just so many scenes where it seems like everything is going just perfectly, like everybody's happy. You got this like golden light filtering through. And yet it's like we're only dimly aware that that lighthearted tone is hiding some sort of tragic reality. And I think that's no more true than in a pretty amazing montage toward the end of this movie. And I think just in spite of the fact that like there's so much heightened emotion and especially confrontations between characters, which is something that's very consistent in his work and something you kind of have to be on board with if you're going to watch any of his movies. I'm just, in spite of all those heightened emotions, it ends up feeling quite realistic. And that's just like a tonal balancing act that I'm not sure many directors can pull off. And he pulls it off here, I think, with aplomb. It's in some ways, it's a very difficult story, but the characters are so memorable. The performances, I think, are iconic. And it's a film about people having to face reality. And while it may be a very tragic film in a lot of ways, I just was so impressed. I remember just after watching it for like days afterward, just like feeling high because I'd really seen something amazing. And that's, you know, it's moments like that that just made me realize like how thankful I am for movies, which is about a high, about as high a compliment as I can give any film.
Yeah, I love that movie so much. Noah, have you seen that movie?
No. Baptiste Maxime, his latest, is the only Xavier Dolan film I've seen. So.
And saw I Killed My Mother.
I'm joining you in the shame pile, Justin.
Okay.
Noah also saw the movie that we reviewed of his together on this podcast, but he consistently forgets that that ever happened. So we'll just let that sit there. I love this movie. I love Dolan. He is a messy filmmaker who wears his heart on his sleeve, and it sometimes goes disastrously wrong, but I kind of love him for trying, even when it does. So I'm a big fan of his, even though not all of his films work. I can't wait to see what he does next.
So what did you have for us, Alex, for this category?
Okay, so I had two very boring choices, but they are like the two best films from the last 10 years that I saw, and they are that I rewatched, really. And they're Mad Max Fury Road and Lady Bird. Mad Max Fury Road, available on HBO Max right now. Yes. Lady Bird, available on Netflix. Two films about strong female protagonists who are just really trying to get to someplace that they feel like will allow them to be self-actualized in a way that we can all relate to, you know? And that's what I like about them. I love that cinema allows us to explore that same story in such very different ways across these two films. But they both just hold up remarkably well to reviewing. And they feature such great characters, and they're both two like perfect films. Like there's nothing in either of these movies that you would change. They both feel such pure distillations of the director's ethos, and I love them both dearly, and they're both fantastic. Mad Max Fury Road and Lady Bird, everybody has probably seen them who is listening to this, so you know that they're great, and you know that they deserve to be a new classic.
I thought about talking about Fury Road, but I am very certain that that has, if not already cemented its place as an all-time great, that it will be remembered that way. So I was like, it doesn't need my vote. It's got it done.
Yeah, definitely two of my favorites from the past decade for sure. And I feel like, and I will say, like, it does seem, unlike other movies that might have gotten acclaim from that year, like those movies feel like movies that just keep getting talked about. You know, it depends what circles you hang out in, I guess, or you know, where you are online, but I do see consistently new works, new essays about each of those, and you know, I think that's a sign of a great film, just the continued love and critical thought that it inspires.
Yep.
Okay, all right, well, we're going to be moving right along here now to this is a very interesting category, I think, because it kind of like our favorite performance category when we talk about a year in review. This gives us a real broad swath of people to talk about, because we're going to be talking about the actor or director that we fell in love with in 2020 from obviously an older film than 2020. So I think this gives us a broad swath to work from, and I'm very curious to hear what direction you guys went with. But I think actually I'll start on this one. This is a director whose very first film I saw at the beginning of 2020, and then saw her most recent film later on this past year. And So her first film is from 1975. Her last one is from technically 2019. And that is the filmmaker Barbara Koppel, documentarian. She's primarily known as a documentarian. She has done, I think, at least one feature film as well. But she's someone who I always heard about. I think I first heard about her on the Film Spotting podcast, which I have referenced already. And specifically her movie Harlan County, USA. That's the film from earlier this year. I should say Desert One is the more recent film of hers. And these are in some ways just very different movies. Harlan County, USA is about a mountain miner strike in Kentucky in the 70s, in which Koppel herself was sort of deeply entrenched and like spent a lot of time like living with the miners' families at that time and documented everything. And it's a very intimate portrait of activism in a sort of newly forming labor union that is ultimately successful in its short-term goals, but by the end we learn it has quite a, you know, that this is not a fight that's over by any means. And the other film that I saw, Desert One, is a much more conventional documentary in a lot of ways. It's actually about Operation Eagle Claw, the failed rescue mission to secure the hostages who were trapped in the embassy in Tehran in 1980. Like I said, much more conventional sort of in its structure. It's a lot more informative, I think, in a lot of ways. But I still think, like, for what it is going for and also for the way the very empathetic approach that she has, I think, is very clear. And that's very clear in all the interviews that she does with the families of people who are involved in the operation, with people who are actually involved. Believe it or not, she actually gets interviews with people who were part of the students who took Americans hostage. And I think she even has empathy there for those people and their struggles and the very real problems that they were facing in Iran at that time. And it's just seeing those kind of very different approaches to documentary and yet seeing an approach that just felt so in tune with the people that she was spending time with. I mean, you really just get the sense that she just like kind of as a matter of course, just forms these relationships over the course of making these movies. And maybe that informs the filmmaking process for her. And in both cases, she has like full access to what's going on. And yet she's able as a documentarian to laser in on what she wants to include and the story that she wants to tell. She's a filmmaker who I would love to see more of her documentaries. I know American Dream is supposed to be one of her truly great ones, a sort of, in a way, maybe a bit of a spiritual sequel, but also perhaps counterpoint to Harlan County, USA, in that the striking workers in that film, which I believe takes place in a Hormel plant, are not successful and what that means for their families. And then the other one that at some point I'd like to catch up with is Shut Up and Sing. About at the time they were known as the Dixie Chicks. They're now currently just known as the Chicks, and the backlash they faced from insulting the current president at the time, George W. Bush, and how that affected them in the industry. She's just someone who's seen. She's someone who's constantly working. I was looking at her filmography, and pretty much from like the 90s on, she's just like making something, whether it's on TV, whether it's a feature. So she's someone who likes to keep busy. I should also mention, for Noah's edification, one of her films that she did in the late 90s is called Conversation with Gregory Peck, which I believe was as part of the American Masters series. So she's someone who seems to have a multitude of interests. There's like, I don't think there's any subject that she is not interested in, but her portraits are very intimate, even when she's working in a more traditional structure. And I just feel like very blessed to have discovered her for the first time after hearing about her for so long. She's someone who I think will just continue to make interesting films and find interesting stories in them. And I think that's kind of her goal. And you know, I want to give as much props to documentaries as we can, because it's something that doesn't always get as discussed as much as your typical narrative feature films, but something that I think is just as valid. So I definitely was happy to discover Barbara Kopple and look forward to checking out more of her stuff.
That's great. I love that choice. My choice, I haven't seen either of those projects. Harlan County USA is one of like the iconic entries into the American documentary canon, so I feel like very remiss to have not seen it yet, but it is streaming on HBO Max right now, if anyone is interested. You'll notice a lot of these films that we're talking about, these classic films, are streaming now on HBO Max for American viewers, and I think that that's notable just because, you know, for all of the problems that service has gotten, all the negative headlines, they have an incredible back catalog of films, and it's really kind of like a must subscribe for people who love cinema. So definitely think that that's interesting that it keeps popping up, but Harlan County USA is yet another example of that.
Great. Did you want to go next, Alex?
Sure. So, you know, I can never choose just one, of course. So instead, I decided to pick one actor and one director. The actor that I fell in love with this year, I saw 5.5 of her films from this year. The half is because one of those films is really just a cameo, so it hardly counts. But yeah, I've seen 5+ features of hers just in this last year. The earliest of which is The Hunger from 1983, and the most recent of which is The Client from 1994. So a nice little 11-year period right there. The actor is Susan Sarandon. She's somebody that I think everybody knows, but I definitely underappreciated. I always liked her in the stuff that I've seen her in, but definitely did not see a lot of her classic film entries, and finally got to catch up with them. So I watched The Hunger in 1983, which was directed by Tony Scott, co-starring Catherine Deneuve and David Bowie as sexy vampires who kind of try to ensnare Susan Sarandon in their plot. But, you know, she's a spunky American, so she has other ideas on how to handle their whole situation. That's like a super arty and 80s and like very sexy and smoky and cool movie that I was not expecting to be as good and interesting as it was. The Witches of Eastwick, 1987, directed by George Miller, starring Cher, Michelle Pfeiffer, Susan Sarandon, Jack Nicholson, the incredible Veronica Cartwright, who I'm really appreciating now as I get older, and also a surprising performance by Richard Jenkins, who is in it like way before anybody knew who Richard Jenkins was. Looks exactly the same age as he does now. I think he was a man who was born at age 40. And but yeah, that's an incredible movie that I think I might be talking about in a little while, so I don't want to get too far into it, but she's great in this. Thelma and Louise, the Ridley Scott film starring Susan Sarandon, Gina Davis, Harvey Keitel, Michael Madsen, and Brad Pitt from 1991. A seminal classic that she is excellent in. Lorenzo's Oil, another George Miller movie, co-starring Nick Nolte, about a woman who and a mother and a father who have a child who has a debilitating disease that they are kind of searching for a cure for as he continues to deteriorate in front of them, based on a true story. Really could be a sort of like Lifetime Story of the Week movie that is so much more than that because of the strong performances and the interesting choices that George Miller makes as a director. And then there's 1992's The Player, which is her cameo appearance. She's basically playing herself in one scene. And then The Client, 1994, directed by Joel Schumacher, co-starring Tommy Lee Jones, Mary Louise Parker, and the great Brad Renfro, who I really liked in that movie and is very sad that he is no longer with us and died so young, so tragically. But basically, all of these movies put together present the picture of a movie star. But not the type of movie star that we're used to seeing now. She's not, leading action franchises or, you know, like, searching for like Oscar bait every single year. It's she's like opening movies, she's selling like she's showing a tremendous amount of range where she gets to be fun and she gets to be sexy and she gets to be nerdy and she gets to be frazzled and charismatic and play drama and play comedy and play romance. And it's just, she just does all of it in such a really compelling way. And it made me want to see a Susan Sarandon career resurgence. You know, she had The Meddler a few years ago and I loved her in that. Certainly, you know, she's not everyone's favorite person because of her outspoken politics, but you know, her politics are not nearly as bad as a lot of people's out there. So at least there's that. And yeah, I loved getting to know her as a real star this past year, exploring these older works. Before I move on, does anybody have any thoughts on Susan Sarandon?
She's definitely someone who I feel like I haven't seen a ton of her stuff, but I've loved everything I've seen her in. And some of the titles you mentioned, Thelma and Louise, it's Thelma and Louise is one of those ones where I always feel like I tend to hear more about Gina Davis. And it was so clear to me that like, I just think both of them are impressive in that movie. They're playing very distinct characters from one another. And yet they're also like kind of trading off who's more in control and who's like is more competent in the moment. And it like just makes so much sense from scene to scene. And I don't know. Like I've seen, like, I agree. Like I loved her in The Meddler. You mentioned like, she's not like, unfortunately not a big action star, though. I was thinking for a second how awesome that would be. and yeah, like, I like what you said about her. Not necessarily, she's not someone who's like seeking out Oscar bait, and who knows, like she does have her Oscar already. So I don't know if that's a factor or not, but she doesn't seem like that kind of person to me. She seems like someone who's seeking out interesting projects and can probably afford to at this point. Yeah, I just hope to see more of her stuff. So I guess that's where I'm at with her.
Yeah, it really made me nostalgic for a period of like Hollywood filmmaking that doesn't exist anymore and that I kind of missed because I was too young to really appreciate it at the time. But like diving into all of those films, it was just a real blast and I really enjoyed my time with her.
Yeah, that's great. Did you have any thoughts about Susan Sarandon, Noah? Or?
Well, I mean, she's part of Cloud Atlas, which, as I've already said, is on my all-time greats
right.
list. but the fact that she was one of that she was just a big proponent of Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump are exactly the same. And from what I've heard, she has learned absolutely nothing from that. I'd just rather not give her the time of day.
Well, you'd be doing yourself a disservice because she's responsible for so many incredible films and, you know, everyone is terrible politics if you get to know them enough.
Well, except for me.
Of course, you're flawless. anyway, my director choice is a director who I kind of like did, you know, I spent a lot of time in 2020 choosing to educate myself on various directors. Some of it was because of, you know, other podcasts that were spotlighting directors. That would be people like Gina Prince Bythewood and George Miller. Some of it was just for my own edification, like Kelly Reichardt, watching all of her films. A director that I did not set out to watch all of his films, but ended up watching a tremendous amount anyway, just by happenstance, is a director called Mike Nichols, who everybody knows, obviously. A new book is out recently about him, but that is not why I selected him. I really just kept choosing movies from the past that I had always wanted to watch, and then I would find out that it was directed by Mike Nichols at a certain point. and that was really fun. And at a certain point, I was like, wow, I'm actually seeing a lot of his films. I ended up seeing six of his films, right? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Yeah, I ended up seeing six of his films, starting from Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf from 1966, starring Elizabeth Taylor, Richard Burton, George Segal, and Sandy Dennis. Then, of course, The Graduate in 1967, which I had never seen before, starring Dustin Hoffman, Anne Bancroft, and Catherine Ross. Heartburn, the 1987 film, which is about the Nora Ephron Carl Bernstein divorce. And yes, it is that Carl Bernstein from All the President's Men. and that starred Meryl Streep as Nora Ephron. and Jack Nicholson as Carl Bernstein. And that was interesting that, and Mike Nichols, was apparently like good friends with the two of them. And so it was a real sort of, tabloidy sort of, choice to make him be the director of that project. Then 1988's Working Girl, starring Melanie Griffith, Harrison Ford, Sigourney Weaver, Joan Cusack, and Alec Baldwin, another classic that I've really enjoyed. Postcards from the Edge, 1990, starring Meryl Streep, Shirley MacLaine, Dennis Quaid, based on Carrie Fisher's memoirs about her complicated relationship with her mother, Debbie Reynolds. And then closing out, Closer, from 2004, starring Clive Owen, Julia Roberts, Natalie Portman, and Jude Law, about a quartet of, you know, people who probably should never be together, to say the least. And yeah, he is, what I've learned, an incredible director of actors. He gets movie stars to be in all of his films, and he uses them really, really well. I am not going to say anything that a million people haven't already said about Mike Nichols. He's, of course, a historic and acclaimed director, but I just really liked getting a chance to get to know him through his work over the years, and I love the diversity of projects that he was associated with. I love how many of them are like focused on interesting female characters, starting with Elizabeth Taylor and going all the way to Natalie Portman in Closer. And it was just a blast to watch all those films and to really finally get like a handle on who he was as a director. I'd seen almost none of his films prior to this year. So this is really fun.
Yeah, wow. I was realizing like, yeah, you watched all those in 2020. Holy crap. yeah, he's someone who like, you know, I tend to associate him, I guess, with like his 60s movies, but you're right. Like he totally worked like for quite a while. And I feel like I don't know if there's been like a consensus on like his sort of on what he brings specifically as a director, like, or like what's something that's like distinct about his identity. Cause I think a lot of times he was working from like other people's scripts and that sort of thing, but I don't think that diminishes his talent in any way. I think it just, if anything, speaks to how he was able to facilitate all of these different stories. And he just strikes me. I know that just like, I just remember reading recently, I don't know if either of you found out, like learned about this, where like there was like an interview with Natalie Portman and she spoke very favorably about him and saying like, he's like the only non-creepy like director she worked with when it came to like scenes that, you know, that involved, let's say sex or sexuality in some way.
Yeah,
and that was very nice to hear. I mean, it's nice to know that that's possible.
Refreshing,
and it certainly seems like it was for this gentleman.
It's refreshing,
and if you've seen Closer, you know that that's actually what a compliment that is, because that's a very like she has a very particular role in that movie that could really be could be really handled poorly in other hands. And so it's nice to hear that feedback from her, because I think it comes across on the screen very well. But yeah, if you see that, there's like a 10-minute scene in that movie where Clive Owen has Natalie Portman in like a private room at a strip club, and he's just like yelling and crying at her while she's trying to do her job, but also maybe trying to manipulate him as well. And it's like a very particular scene that I think goes that is handled really well, and it could have been handled very poorly. And I'm glad she felt like that also when she made the movie.
Yeah. And I will say just one last thing about Nichols is that I saw his production of Betrayal on Broadway with Rachel Weisz, Daniel Craig, and Rafe Spall. And it's the best live theater I think I've ever seen. So, guy could direct whether it was on stage or on film.
Yeah, he is known for being a good stage director as well. And also, you know, notably, one of the few things that I had seen of his before this was the Angels in America adaptation that he did for HBO in 2001. So, you know, he has a long history.
He directed that?
Yeah, he directed that.
Nice.
Yeah. And very that's nice. Obviously excellent. So yeah, really good. Mark Harris has a new book on him that just came out recently. And interesting enough, Mark Harris's husband is the playwright for Angels of America. So, you know, he got to know him up close and then wrote a very interesting book about him and his like filmography. So if you're if you're interested in learning more about Mike Nichols, definitely don't continue to listen to me. Check out Mark Harris's book instead. But yeah, I really enjoyed my time with him over the years, or over the last year, I should say. And quick runner up for the acting category. I also got to know Sigourney Weaver a bit better and Shirley MacLaine a bit better, and those were both really fun as well. I saw six movies from each of those actresses, and they're great. Sigourney Weaver especially just has like a tremendous amount of range. She is so funny in Working Girl, in a way that I think is underrated.
Did not know that was the character she was going to play, and it was a delight.
She's perfect in it. And then Shirley MacLaine I saw in like a million things, and she's just excellent in every single one of them. Like, she's great in Terms of Endearment, in Postcards from from the Edge, in The Apartment, in Steel Magnolias, and in her shoes, I should say. She's also in Bewitched, and I saw that, and like I liked that more than most people would, but you know, whatever. Fun getting to see more of Shirley MacLaine's work.
Well, now I'm very curious about what Noah has prepared for this category, because I have no idea what direction he's going to go in. So let's find out.
Well, I'm glad Alex had so many examples and watched so many movies. I have the problem that in 2020, I barely watched anything. I barely watched enough 2020 movies to make a top 10 list, and I only occasionally... usually through force of will, watched something older than 2020. And all of the things like prior to 2020 that I watched were almost universally stuff that I already knew or was pretty sure, or were at least like, you know, in the case of Seven and Zodiac, I already know David Fincher. I already know all the main performers in those movies. So like, I can't pretend that this was the year I fell in love with Morgan Freeman playing the older Wiseman character, because I already knew that he can do that.
Is this the year that you fell in love with Gwyneth Paltrow?
No. It's the year I fell in love with Goop. No.
Oh, God. Danger Will Robinson.
So, okay. I'm going to go with a Chinese actor who plays a side but still significant character in the 2019 Chinese hit series The Untamed. And it is the live-action adaptation of an online novel or novella. It's like, as from what I understand, it doesn't actually exist in printed book form. And it is a Chinese fantasy story that takes place in a world where there are spiritual powers and swords with special powers and people who cultivate these powers. And then there are good guys and bad guys, and they fight each other for control of the country or the empire, as it's vaguely defined. And there are clan rivalries. And it's this huge, in many ways, it's a very like classic epic fantasy story in a lot of its elements. The difference is, it is super, super gay and super homoerotic because the two main characters are two guys who very clearly fall in love. And in the book, their relationship becomes very, very physical. The live action adaptation could not get that explicit because the Chinese government has very strict censorship laws regarding homosexuality. So they had to code all that. But still, the show consists of incredibly pretty young Chinese men staring very, very longingly at each other. It is not the sort of show I usually watch, but my wife started watching it. I started watching it with her. And it's also, it like the show is specifically, I'm forgetting the term for it, but there's a term for a very, a particular type of Chinese action.
Wuxia?
Yes, that's what it is. So it's done in that style. So like the fights and the action scenes involve a lot of strings. So in the West, most people know this style through the Ang Lee movie Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. Like, for most people in the U.S., that's been their exposure to this type of filmmaking or storytelling. So that's the style that the show's in. And it is very campy in a lot of ways, but the characters are so perfectly cast and they have such incredible chemistry. Like, whether it's romantic / homoerotic or not, the characters just bounce off each other in incredibly fun ways. And it is so, I'm still kind of astounded at how well the show drew me in, given that it was so completely outside of the type of thing that I usually watch. I love pretty much any type of fantasy related setting. But this particular style, this wuxia style is not something that I would consider like a favorite style of mine. And also I'm not in on the scene of like homoerotic storytelling like my wife is, who works for a company that does distribution for LGBTQ movies. So as my wife herself puts it, her life is 90% gay shit. And this show very much falls under that.
Yep. Just remind me the names of the actors.
So the specific actor that I'm talking about is the actor Yu Bin, who plays the character of Wen Ning, who is he is a character who he's super quiet and shy and like has a stutter and is very modest and just wants to be left alone. But he happens to be possessed by a demon that gives him like unbelievably strong powers. So he basically can't die. Like, the bad guys try to kill him at some point, but one of the main characters like kind of in air quotes resurrects him. And then he basically like serves as his like right hand man for the remainder of the story. And he's this super strong and super powerful character. And before he's been introduced, you hear these stories about how like, oh, terrifying he is. And how about, you know, all these people are scared of this legendary warrior who could never be defeated. And like, oh, well, everyone assumes he's dead at the beginning. Oh, thank God he's dead and we never have to face him again. But he's just a puppy dog. He is an absolute sweetheart and a puppy dog of a person. He literally has puppy dog eyes in every scene. He's absolutely adorable. And he just like, I completely like it. I can like, eat, like, as, sorry, I'm losing my power of speech. And here's the thing, like, despite the fact that I'm like very, very straight, I completely fell in love with him because he is just so cute and adorable in every scene. And I always felt so bad as to how at how all these characters keep trying to like abuse him. There's this running theme where whenever he and the two main characters are going somewhere, like, children will suddenly appear and will just start running around him and kicking a ball around him, and he just sort of like stands there and is like helpless to. He can't even tell a bunch of kids like, "Hey, get out of my way! I have to get somewhere." He just stands there and starts like calling out for his master. He's like, "Help me! These kids are playing around me, and I can't get free of this." It's hard to describe. You have to watch the show to get a feeling for just how deeply it can worm its way into your heart. But yeah, no, Yu Bin is my forever beau after seeing that show. I would say, especially if you think you wouldn't like it, give it a chance, because it really does. The whole show really does grow on you.
Do you know, is there anything like that he's been in previous, or like, is there anything that he's going to be in the future?
I could not tell you that.
Okay.
He does not have a Wikipedia page.
But so, you're looking forward to seeing him in other things.
If actually there is, it's not available here yet, but they've already done a spin-off movie with his character and another character from The Untamed, where they go on like a parallel adventure after the events of The Untamed show. So I will watch that. My wife and I both are eagerly awaiting for that to somehow be available here. But yeah, no, outside of the Untamed universe, like, I'm not connected to the Chinese cinema world, so I don't know how I would know this, but if someone mentioned to me, "Hey, by the way, he's in a new thing," I would definitely give it a look.
Gotcha.
Well, I guess that's something to look out for.
Yeah. So let's move on to our last topic here. We've got our best rewatch, and we have mentioned some rewatches before, but I'm kind of curious about what other ones we'd like to talk about here. Let's start with you, Alex, on your favorite rewatch.
Sure. So I have a lot of runners up for this, as you might imagine. The way that I kind of separated was like, what are the best movies that I saw that I rewatched, like my favorite films that I happened to rewatch in 2020? And for that list, it's easy. It's like some of my favorite films of all time. It's Broadcast News. It's Before Sunset. It's Aliens. It's Toy Story 3 and Avengers Endgame. Like all of these movies, incredibly rewatchable, new insights every time we see them. I loved them before. I love them even more now. But the film that I'm going to pick for my best rewatch of the year is a film that I saw for the first time in 2020 and then watched again later on in 2020, which really, I think, shows how much I liked the movie and how much I enjoyed rewatching it. And that would be Witches of Eastwick, the film that I mentioned previously, the 1987 film directed by George Miller, starring Susan Sarandon and Michelle Pfeiffer and Cher and Jack Nicholson and, as I said earlier, Veronica Cartwright and Richard Jenkins. This movie is such a blast. I'd never seen it. I really didn't know that much about it. I knew, like, the broad strokes because it was adapted into a pretty miserable TV show for ABC a number of years ago. Yes. I just loved this movie. As soon as I saw it, I wanted to watch it again and show it to everyone that I knew because it's just such a blast. It's really about these three friends who kind of, over the course of the film, find out that they may be witches and have magical powers, but also, like, really just want, you know, at the beginning of the film, they're lonely and, like, they want to have a fantasy man kind of sweep them off their feet. And then Jack Nicholson comes to town as maybe the devil, and is each of their fantasies that they may have conjured by accident. And then it kind of goes from there, and it's, like, this really fun exploration of, like, toxic masculinity and of female relationships and about, like, sex in a small town. And, you know, there's this, like, a remarkable sequence of, like children and like sex and bubbles and wow, like lobster. And it's just like they go to a mansion and they just, like, have a crazy bacchanal of situations. The children are not involved in the sex part, I should be extremely clear.
Yes.
It's more like they
do not endorse pedophilia.
No, not at all. It's more that they, like, bring, like, the Michelle Pfeiffer character has a lot of kids, and she, like, brings them to the mansion at some point, and, like, they're running around in all these, like, bubbles, and, like, the women are, like, floating in the air, and it's just, like, this insane thing. And then later, in a scene after that, there's, like, a crazy sort of sex orgy thing happening that the children are not at all involved in. Actually, interestingly enough, the children really kind of come and go in the movie, and as a whole, there's a lot of parts where you're just like, but wait, doesn't Michelle Pfeiffer have, like, 8 children? Who is watching? What is happening with that? So they do kind of forget that. But yeah. The actresses are so, so fun. It's just three excellent movie star performances from them. And Jack Nicholson is just, like, utter trash in the most perfect way possible. And it's just so funny, the deconstruction of toxic masculinity that his character represents in a movie from the 80s. And it's just also, like, it goes to some really wild places by the end that you're just not expecting. Like, even me telling you this, you will not be, like, prepared for what ends up happening. It's just an utter blast and really weird and unexpected, and just, like, you can't imagine that this just, like, came out on a Tuesday, like, on a Friday and, like, a random week, you know, just being like, yeah, here's the new movie. And also, it's based off of a John Updike novel, and it seems to be a significant improvement on that John Updike novel from what I've learned about that John Updike novel. They make some important changes to it, and I think that the film significantly benefits from it. And,
like, not,
you know,
involving the kids in the sex scenes? Was that one of the changes?
Yeah, I really regret bringing up all of those things at the same time. It was just kind of like all the stuff that was There's, but
what he means
but, yeah.
to say, viewers, is he regrets bringing them up around me because now I won't let him forget it.
No, I just regret it. I regret a lot of things. But yeah, the film's really
good. Cinema Joes, you regret a lot of things.
And it's also just wild, like, this is directed by George Miller, who everyone knows is the director of Mad Max Fury Road. It's such a, like,
and
on its face, you're just like, what? Why would he make this movie? That's so unlike what he usually does. But when, like, I had the chance to watch all of his films in a pretty close amount of time over the course of the year.
Very, very diverse filmography.
100%. He really, but the thing about him is that you always know which movie, that you always know that it's his movie, even though the movies have a great variety in terms of genre and tone and setting, because he just goes for it. And like, he never ever puts like 30% effort into something. He just he takes the extension of whatever the idea is and he just does it to 110% in a way that like other directors think they're doing that, and it's called like maximalist filmmaking, and it's like very macho and it's very like in your face, and like that's not his deal at all. It's just he just takes the premise and he takes like the way of framing things and just executes as hard as he possibly can.
You
and
will
it's just
cry
great
about this pig.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, I mean, if you liked this movie as much as I did, you might be interested in learning more about the filmmaking of it. And there's a lot of fun stories about, like, I mean, this movie basically like turned George Miller off from Hollywood filmmaking like completely. Like, he had such a horrible experience with producers and that he basically said, I'm never working in Hollywood again, and he has not. So that's notable. You know, it's obviously a ton of movie stars just like at their full powers. Cher, like the Susan Sarandon was cast to play the role that Cher ended up playing, and Cher was just like, I'm only being in this movie if I get to be that person. And they were like, okay, fine. And Susan Sarandon showed up on set the first day still thinking she was playing one character, and then they were like, no, we gave it to Cher, and then she had to just prepare for an entirely different character, which is just wild.
Oh my
something
gosh.
Like that could happen, because Susan Sarandon, very famous actress at that point in time, not like a newbie at all, so really, you know, saying something. And yeah, it's just, there's like a crazy story about how there's like one infamous producer insisted on putting an alien in the movie, despite there being no reason for an alien to be put in the movie. And there's just like a lot of fun stories around this movie. And it's the same year that Cher won her Oscar for Moonstruck. So she had this movie come out in July, and then she had Moonstruck come out in the fall, and she won an Oscar. So this was like one of the highest grossing films of the year. And then she had Moonstruck as her Oscar win. So it's just like really just like peak Cher movie star moment. But yeah, it's a lot of fun. Everybody would like it. And the effects, it has some major special effects, and they hold up surprisingly well, given that it's a film from the 80s.
Wow. Yeah, I've mostly, like, most of what I know about this film is from what you've told me about it over the years. Not over the years, over the year, I guess.
Because I haven't stopped talking about it for the last year, yeah.
And it just sounds like, it sounds so nutty that it's like, I almost like wonder if my expectations are just like so high, just in terms of like everything the film is going to give me. So,
I really
but
think
I'm definitely, I mean, it's George Miller, so it wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah, it doesn't quite have the existential dread that Babe Pig in, to Pig in the City has, but you know, it's, right. It's really good.
All right. Let's. How about we go to you, Noah, for your best rewatch?
All right. So the rewatches that I want to highlight. I recently read a book by Susan Napier called Miyazaki World, and it's a book where she goes film by film through the career of Hayao Miyazaki, and really goes. It's not that long of a book, but she goes really deep into like what place Miyazaki was in his life, what state of mind he was in or seems to have been in based on his interviews and public statements at the time that he made each movie, and really goes into what possible influences, or in some cases, what known influences from his own life and experiences went into creating each movie that he made when he made them. So reading that book combined with the fact that nearly either all or nearly all of the Studio Ghibli canon is now available on Netflix.
Correction. It's available on Netflix outside of the US. It's available on HBO Max inside the US.
Ah, okay. All right. Thank you for that. I'm long term. I want to go back just for my own benefit and rewatch all of Hayao Miyazaki's movies and all of the Studio Ghibli canon as well for however much time I take to actually do that. And so far, I've gone back to rewatch My Neighbor Totoro, Kiki's Delivery Service, and Castle in the Sky, or Laputa, depending on what language the title is in, which are all, how could I describe this? They're from the first half of Miyazaki's career. So before he made Porco Rosso, which is considered like one of his first like really adult movies, and Princess Mononoke, which is also a very adult movie, and also before he made his more commercially successful films like Spirited Away and Howl's Moving Castle. And it's just, it is always a treat to go back and revisit any one of his films. And I think the one that I would like to highlight the most, which I rewatched, I think at this point about 3 months ago, was when I went back to rewatch Kiki's Delivery Service, which I had fond memories of the first time that I'd seen it. But going back and rewatching it, I definitely think it's one of his best movies, and it's partly because of just how what I think makes Miyazaki movies so special is how attuned he is to the many small ways that you can grasp both the positive sides of just existing as a human being and the negative sides. So he'll have all these quiet, touching moments between Kiki and all of this really colorful batch of characters in this coastal city that Kiki decides to move to and take up residence in, like the baker, her husband, who doesn't say a word for the entire film, but you remember every time he's on screen just because he has this incredible design about him. To the old ladies who help Kiki set up her service, to the artist that she meets in the woods. And she has all these just wonderful, reaffirming, positive experiences over the course of the film with all of them that help her find her way as she's, you know, going through her coming of age story. But it also touches on those moments of sorrow or disappointment when something happens that disappoints Kiki or upsets her, or where she herself isn't quite certain if she's happy or sad. Like one moment that stood out to me in particular is when she has this adventure with the young boy that she befriends, and they go on this bike ride. He has like this half bike, half helicopter concoction that he wants to try out. It doesn't work that well and it breaks at the end, but they have fun trying it out and they have a big laugh. And then some friends of his come by and like sort of kind of in air quotes steal him away. Or at least Kiki sort of like they invite Kiki to come along with them, but she's just sort of like, oh, no, you go. I have to go back to work. And it's so real, that moment, because I think we've all had moments like that where you're in a moment, you're in an experience, and then something from the outside world comes in and breaks it off. And it's not even necessarily a good or bad thing. Just the fact that that moment has been interrupted kind of leaves you feeling off and a little weird and a little like, this thing I was enjoying is over now, and I'm not really happy about that. Like, not even necessarily because someone was trying to distract you. It's just something has interrupted a moment you were having, and you're kind of feeling a little unsatisfied or a little disappointed. And it's amazing how Miyazaki and his team were able to use the medium of animation to convey that sense without Kiki saying anything. She just goes back to her room and just sort of passes out on the bed like that. Yeah, there's a reason that I think that moment specifically has found sort of an extra life as a GIF or a GIF on the internet when people are like, oh, when you're feeling disappointed about something or when this bad thing happens. And it's just the shot of Kiki just flopping down on her bed, you know, And she doesn't say anything. No, there's no dialogue. I don't even think there's music in the moment, but just the way that it's animated so perfectly conveys that very, very real emotion. It's just, yeah, it's like, I remember, like, I think I liked the movie plenty when I mean, all of Miyazaki's movies, when I first saw them, I was like, well, that's obviously a great movie. But Kiki's is definitely one of the ones that I think has improved the most upon a revisitation. And I would definitely, for me personally, I think I would rank it alongside Spirited Away, Princess Mononoke, and I think Porco Rosso is my personal favorites from his filmography.
Yes. I absolutely love this film. It's such an underrated gem, in my opinion. Kiki is the most relatable character that exists in a Miyazaki film. And yeah, she's just great. It's a bizarre world where, because she's a witch, she's 13 and she just has to like work for a living in a new town. But like, also it just feels very relatable in terms of just like what it's like to have to be a grown up when you don't feel like you're ready to be one and like all that stuff. And it's just like deeply, like, it's been called the millennial Miyazaki movie. And I think that it totally deserves that. So it's just an incredibly great film, and I love that you're highlighting it here.
And that's usually the case whenever there's a fantastical element in his films, which, I mean, you in films like Kiki's Delivery Service, like My Neighbor Totoro, like Porco Rosso, or even I think to a lesser extent as well, I think also Castle in the Sky, there are these fantastical, either fantasy or sci-fi elements, or maybe a mix of the two, but there is something otherworldly in the world, like the existence of witchcraft or the existence of furry troll-like creatures in the woods. But that's not the focus. It's that those are really incidental. They're just avenues through which to explore human concepts like growing up, adapting to a changing world, learning to be independent. You know, Kiki's ability to fly, like her witchcraft almost solely consists of her ability to fly. And the flying sequences in the movie are absolutely amazing, but they're less consequential to the story than the concept of flight and how it ultimately connects to Kiki growing up as a person and this journey of her, like, eventually losing her ability to fly and the way she gains that back. Like, that's the focus of the movie, not the fact that, you know, she goes on these adventures in the sky. That's just like, that's just sort of the window dressing to the core of the story. And that's what I think is also very unique about him in general. He'll take these fantastical ideas and say, okay, that's there, but it's only there as a means to an end and not there so that I can have, you know, a big set piece that takes place in the sky or involving these fantastical creatures.
Absolutely.
All right. So I'll close it out here with my favorite rewatch. And this is a film that I believe both of you are very familiar with. And it's one that I didn't like the first time I saw. And I saw it this time and absolutely loved it. So clearly, Justin from 10 years ago was a very different person from who I am now. I rewatched Being John Malkovich.
Oh,
by,
wow.
Spike Jonze, written, of course, by Charlie Kaufman. I believe his first produced feature film screenplay. Yeah, I don't know what it was. I mean, for those who don't know, this is, it's kind of about an office clerk played by John Cusack. He finds, without getting into too much detail, finds a portal into John Malkovich's head. Yes, that John Malkovich, who plays a version of himself. And at a certain point, discovers that not only can he be inside John Malkovich's head and see exactly what he's doing, but can actually control him like a kind of puppet master, which is appropriate given that John Cusack's character has aspirations as a sort of avant-garde marionette performer. And I don't know what it was. Like, I was watching it this time, and I was wondering if maybe the reason I didn't respond to it very well the first time is because there's all different kinds of various tonal changes throughout this thing, and it's a lot to follow and keep track of. And this time it just all made sense. It all just kind of flowed. I think the other reason why I didn't like it the first time is because I guess I assumed watching it that we were supposed to be sympathetic to the Cusack character. Oh, and watching it this time was like, no, this is not a good person. But yet it's very, I think at the same time, it acknowledged that this guy probably has talent, and yet it also fully acknowledges his toxicity. And he's certainly not alone. But I think it's just the sheer inventiveness of this movie from start to finish. This idea of control and manipulation and what that does to you, but also maybe the liberations that it can inspire, depending on who's in control. It's this, there's always this sense of people being hurt or people being manipulated in this movie, and yet it's also kind of a fact of life, and it's something that all these different characters, including ones played by Cameron Diaz and Catherine Keener, have to wrestle with and kind of, I think, come to a certain understanding of themselves and what they really want as a result. Even though there's quite a bit of let's say nefarious activities in the course of that. Just loved this. I just loved the momentum of it, the propulsiveness of it. I don't think you can, like, as much as Charlie Kaufman's fingerprints are all over this, I think this probably would have felt very different if he had directed it. And I feel like I maybe like him a little bit less as a director than I do as a writer. I mean, I've definitely, I still think Schenectady, New York is a masterpiece. And I was actually somewhat pretty high on Thinking of Ending Things. But I don't know. There's just something about Jones's approach, which just, even when it's dealing with more tragic subject matter or like dark existential questions, it still has this buoyancy, this sense of joie de vivre and just energy to it. And it's just, it's such an interesting counterpoint, but yet it works so well. So I just loved revisiting this film. I actually saw a couple of films from 1999, just this past year, some of which were revisits, some of which were new ones that I'm just like, oh shit, 1999 was an amazing year for movies, most of which were not nominated for Best Picture. Anyway, I love this film. So glad to revisit it.
I'm glad he came around. That's a personal favorite of mine.
I'm a big fan of Charlie Kaufman's work overall. I think that I watched John Malkovich originally out of order in a way that kind of hurt me, because I saw Malkovich last after watching all of his other films up until that point. And I definitely liked his other films more. And I feel like if I had seen it in the reverse order, I would have appreciated it a little bit more. But I definitely think it's a very, very good film. So I'm glad you finally caught up with it.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think we're going to close there. And hopefully there'll be many more films to come from from the past and classics that we'll either revisit or see anew in the coming years. But let's end it there, and let's talk about where we can find everybody these days. We'll start with you, Noah. Where can we find you on the internet?
Well, in addition to my work here with the Cinema Joes, you can also catch the podcast on Genesis that I did with Justin for Pop Break. And you can also check out my written work on my blog at francenoir.blogspot.com.
Great. You can find me at thecinemaverick.com. I'm also on Letterboxd at thecinemaverick. I do just want to say the podcast that Noah mentioned before, Pod on the Rooftops, that is part of the Breakcast podcast feed. So you might have to find us on the Pop Break just to go, because it has been a little while since we've done it, but we are very proud of it, and we hope that you check it out. Let's go to Alex next. Where can we find you on the internet?
Sure, you can follow me on Twitter at Media Thinkings and on Letterboxd at Media Thinkings. Over at Letterboxd, I have I have my Best of 2020 list up. I also have a Year Without Movie Theaters, which is a ranked list that I've put together starting in March 2020 and going until March 2021 with every single film, new and old, that I've seen in that span of time. So if you're curious to see more of the stuff that I've been catching up on, you can definitely check me out there. I want to make a note that in our show notes for this week, I will have listed every film that we've been discussing and also where you can find them on the internet as well. So whether they're available on streaming services or VOD, just because we threw a lot of stuff at you. And if you're interested in finding them, I want to make it a little easier for everybody. you can follow our show at Cinema Joes on Twitter. You can check us out on Anchor and Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, all the rest. You can also follow my work on thepotbreak.com. I am the podcast editor over there, so I'm overseeing all of our podcasts. We have about 13 podcasts running right now across several feeds, but you can see everything that we're doing if you just go over to thepotbreak.com and click on podcasts. Also, I host two of those podcasts, TV Break and Goodbye to All That. They're TV related. We're covering this month, we're covering Superman and Lois, and we're covering WandaVision. So you can check those out. I just finished up writing weekly recaps of WandaVision for thepotbreak.com. So if you want to check out that work, you'd see that over there. And I'm doing a monthly superhero TV column called Super Sundays with Alex that come out the first Sunday of every month. So you can check my column out over there as well.
Awesome. Well, we want to thank all of our listeners and all of our subscribers. Thank you for sticking with us for the Cinema Joes. This is Justin Mancini signing off.